Gaudiamus for this Christmas season from me, Maria Zylstra, for Lingua Franca, and introducing this week, the first in the Radio National Summer Series, focusing on some of the fascinating books we looked in over the past year, and beginning with Bruce Moore, the director of the Australian National Dictionary Centre, with his review of Robert McCrum's book, Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language, which is the big picture of how, sometime last century, the English language stopped being the tongue just of the ethnically English, becoming one for many, many more peoples as well. So here he is again, Bruce Moore.
Robert McCrum is an associate editor of the British newspaper The Observer, a biographer of the English writer P.G. Wodehouse, and also author of some six novels. I associate him strongly with the award-winning nine-part television series and companion book The Story of English, which appeared in 1986. And now, after more than two decades, McCrum has returned to the matter of English with a book titled Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. And what a triumphant return it is. A challenging and thoroughly readable account of the supranational triumph of English in the third millennium. McCrum attributes the term Globish to Jean-Paul Nerriere, a French-speaking former IBM executive and amateur linguistic scholar, and dates it to 1995. Before this, various terms had been used to describe the phenomenon of English becoming a lingua franca across the planet. The earliest was World English, dating from the 1920s, but becoming widespread in the 1970s. International English dates from about 1980, and Global English from about the same period. Globish is, of course, a blend of global plus English, and draws into its connotations such terms as global village, global economy, globalisation, and the like. As a way of forming new words, the blend was hardly known in English until the end of the 19th century. This method of word formation was popularised by Lewis Carroll, who introduced the term portmanteau word in Through the Looking Glass. Humpty Dumpty explains, "Well, slithy means lithe and slimy. You see, it's like a portmanteau. There are two meanings packed up into one word." By the end of the 20th century, when most people had forgotten what a portmanteau bag was, the portmanteau blend had become one of the most common ways of forming new words in English. And so it is fitting that the morphing of English into global English should be marked by a further morphing of global English into globish. This new word globish also matches that procession of similar blends: Singlish, Hinglish, Chinglish, Spanglish, Benglish, Japlish, blends that are the children, or cousins, or orphans, or indeed bastards of globish. The family metaphors I use here are especially appropriate to McCrum's book, for globish is as much a biography of English as it is a history. While it is obvious that English has been subject to the vagaries and fortunes of historical events, the escape from French domination in the medieval period, the expansion of the British Empire in the 19th century, and the political, economic, and cultural power of the United States in the 20th century, central to McCrum's argument is the notion that English, as a result of its history, has a special character. On a number of occasions, McCrum summarises its character in this way: irrepressibly contagious, adaptable, populist, and subversive. This is a characterisation that weaves itself as a leitmotif throughout the book. And the biographical approach is one that gives new life to those sections of the book where McCrum traverses some of the more familiar areas of the history of English, from its beginnings in Anglo-Saxon to its skirmishes with the Romano-Celts and the Vikings, and to its long engagement, first with Norman French and then with Central French. This is the period when English reveals what I like to call its promiscuousness, its propensity to grab words from any language in order to make its stock richer and more subtle. this willingness to borrow words freely from other languages continues into the Renaissance, with numerous borrowings from Latin and Greek, and on to the words that are absorbed as a result of the discovery of the languages of the New World and beyond. Eager gobbling up of new words is one of the features that distinguishes English from the protectionist French and the endlessly compounding Germans. The French, of course, produced their academy and attempted to prescribe what was allowable in language. Suggestions that English should have its own academy to protect its purity were certainly put forward, most notably by Jonathan Swift, but an English academy was never a real possibility, partly because of the English language's distinctive features. The telling contrast between England and France is encapsulated at a later date in the editing of dictionaries. In France, with its academy, it took 40 academicians 40 years to produce a national dictionary. In England, it was Samuel Johnson, the archetypal English amateur, as Macrum describes him, who would out-dictionary all the French in 7 years with his 1755 Dictionary of the English Language. Macrum comments, "In France, the process of writing a national dictionary codified, solidified, and ultimately fossilized the language. For English, the dictionary process achieved the exact opposite. It gave expression to its contagious adaptability, catchy populism, and innate subversiveness. The mongrel character of English gives it toughness, and this is one of the qualities that Macrum ascribes to the English language that might have been obliterated by the Norman conquest, but which fought on outside and below the power domains of church, law, and state, and re-emerged in the 14th century some 30,000 words the richer." Macrum describes English's relationship to French in this period as a subtle accommodation to an alien power, a mixture of aggressive, covert resistance and ingenious collaboration. The mongrel is still there in the 16th century, when English becomes the vehicle for religious and political rebellion, especially in the form of the English Bible. The genius is there in the English Renaissance, in the great feast of language that is Shakespeare and the King James Bible. Macrum fills the argument out with fascinating historical and literary detail. The only detail I missed was that moment when, in 1559, the young Elizabeth is entering the city of London on the way to coronation via a series of elaborate allegorical pageants, when at one of them, an angel descends and presents to her a copy of the Bible in English, encapsulating a rejection of the Catholic Queen Mary and an embracing of the power of English. In the following centuries, first in America and then in many other countries, English became the language of a colonizing force. In the 20th century, with the political decline of Britain, the United States took over as the controller and distributor of English. But one of the important features of Macrum's argument in this regard is that he does not see the shift from Britain to the United States as simply a handing over of the linguistic baton. Rather, the baton had reinvented itself. Macrum says, "The English founders of the language gave way to the American pioneers, and words have always been the key to North America." As a lexicographer, I've been very familiar with Noah Webster's comments on the role of language in American society. Writing soon after the American Revolution in 1789, Webster had this to say: "As an independent nation, our honour requires us to have a system of our own, in language as well as government. Great Britain, whose children we are and whose language we speak, should no longer be our standard." Webster's changes to the spelling in his 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language were part of this linguistic nationalism. But what Macrum demonstrated for me was the extent to which Noah Webster was but one manifestation of an American obsession with the potential power of English. Of course, there were those who wanted to fix and purify the language. But Thomas Jefferson, the third president, wrote, "Judicious neology can alone give strength and copiousness to language and enable it to be the vehicle of new ideas." John Adams, the second president, writing in 1780, was especially prescient about the forthcoming power of English. He wrote, "English is destined to be in the next and succeeding centuries more generally the language of the world than Latin was in the last, or French is in the present age." And again, "You must know I have undertaken to prophesy that English will be the most respectable language in the world and the most universally read and spoken in the next century." In America, English becomes a new thing, most evident perhaps in the language of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Elements of Black American speech are evident in Twain, but they emerge more strongly in the 20th century and merge with the mainstream language. The American experience is further evidence for McCrum of the ability of English to change and adapt, to attach itself to winners. The dissemination of British English in the 19th century and American English in the 20th century were closely linked to economic, political, and cultural power. English came to be used widely in many countries, in international business, in international forums, and so on, partly as a matter of necessity and partly as a matter of prestige. But at the very core of McCrum's book is the argument that towards the end of the 20th century, a particular set of circumstances enabled English to jump battleship, as it were, and to break free of its British and American masters. McCrum focuses on the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989 as a crucial event, since it led to a breakdown of traditional hostilities and geographical divisions. This change in the distribution of power coincided with revolutionary advances in communications technology. The invention of the printing press in the 15th century heralded one revolution in human communication. The World Wide Web was the next, and one of its effects was to dismantle the traditional political and geographical barriers to communication. English has become the language of the third millennium, partly through those qualities it gathered to itself in its chronological history, and partly through its usurpation of history at the end of the 20th century. It has become a power in itself. McCrum is optimistic that this triumph of English as the international lingua franca will not lead to the destruction of other languages, and points to the way the communications revolution is enabling many of those other languages to be heard. He is also confident that even if political circumstances change, there is no other language that could serve any dominant imperialistic power in the way that English can. Thus, while McCrum readily admits that if Germany had won the Second World War, English might now be a minor world language, his main point is that since that time, the world has changed irrevocably. English has broken free of any special association with a people, creed, philosophy, nation or region. Its time has come. This is an informative, challenging and thoroughly readable book. I recommend it wholeheartedly.
Published by Penguin in the imprint Viking, Robert McCrum's book Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language is available in softback. Check the Lingua Franca website for the details. Bruce Moore, the enthusiastic reviewer, is the director of the Australian National Dictionary Centre based at the ANU in Canberra. And for Lingua Franca, I'm Maria Zylstra with season's greetings. Till next week.
New to ABC Books is Words Fail Me by Hugh Lunn. This sequel to the popular Lost for Words intertwines the sayings and phrases of yesteryear with true stories and anecdotes. Hugh Lunn examines our language in contrast to the modern era of jargon and corporate speak, attempting to recapture what Australia used to be like back when. ABC Books' Words Fail Me, from ABC Shops, Centres and ABC Shop Online.